This is KZSU, Stanford. You're listening to Entitled Opinions on Life and Literature with Robert Harrison. I'm Alexandra Moore, the show's producer, and today we're merrily rebroadcasting an episode of Abby Waldhausen's Mirandist poetry podcast, The Lovely Wallpaper, where Robert was invited to speak about the winter solstice. Please be sure to check out A Lovely Wallpaper on Apple Podcasts, which offers guided memorizations of a new poem each program. In our version, you'll hear Robert recite A Nocturnal Upon St. Lucy's Day over a guitar piece he composed and recorded as an accompaniment for the poem. So without further ado, we'll turn things over to Abby.
Welcome to A Lovely Wallpaper, a podcast exploring an underappreciated way of appreciating poetry by committing it to memory. To know a poem by heart means having a worry stone, a provocation, a comfort, a quick exit, always close at hand. Lose yourself in a poem, gain a world with its mastery.
The art of losing, it sounds hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost, that a loss is no disaster.
In this episode, we will work with the helpful voice of Robert Harrison, who is a professor of Italian and French literature at Stanford University, author of such books as Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age, and Gardens, An Essay on the Human Condition, to name just a couple, and host of the long-running KZSU radio program entitled Opinions About Life and Literature. He will be presenting A Nocturnal Upon St. Lucy's Day by John Donne. If you haven't listened to Entitled Opinions yet, you must. It has been on air for 20 years. In some episodes, Robert invites fellow academics to talk about their work. And in others, he produces rangy and beautiful monologues on topics like willows or the wind, or depression, or amor mundi, the love of world. What I admire most is the way he uses poetry to forge a path through, in his own words, this forest of symbols we walk through in life. The approach to keep poetry in dialogue with the lived world is very near and dear to my heart. I had planned to skip doing a December episode this year because the month is so busy. But the other night, I was sitting on my couch with a lot of things to do, but unwilling to focus either my mind or my eyes. I wondered to myself, why is this the season, the closing of the year, when just staring widely and blankly can spark such depths of feeling? There's something about the tangles of string light inside and out, our neighbors and our own, and all their reflections that is arrestingly exuberant and sad at once. It was a relief to sit, eyes open but not searching, and this diffuse gaze felt the best way to let the contrasts and the symbol-rich textures of the season truly penetrate, and to honor this time of darkness and light, dormancy and rebirth. In this porous and dreamy state, I remembered an episode of Entitled Opinions from a few years ago, which Robert recorded in tribute to the winter solstice. In it, he read Poems of Darkness by Percy Bysshe Shelley, by Andrea Zanzotto, and of course by John Donne. Re-listening to these poems and to Robert's praise of the winter solstice, it felt like a fitting way to stay in this space of imaginative contemplation. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you, Abby. That was a beautiful monologue. Very appropriate for this time of year.
Well, Robert, I contacted you because I remembered this wonderful episode you did on the winter solstice where you read a few poems and played some music and thought about the season and its many layers. So I'd say I wanted to talk to you about the episode, but I also just kind of want to enter into that world again. Will you talk to me a little bit about your affinity for the season and your love for this shortest day?
Yes. I mean, it's not that I don't love the summer solstice as well. I did also a show on the summer solstice, but there's something about the winter solstice that's unique in its spiritual evocations and its resonance in the depths, as you call it, of darkness. I believe that not only all life gestates in the dark, but even the universe, I think, was generated out of darkness. So there's something about a kind of matrix, darkness as a generator of being, and being at this time of year where the night is the longest, the day is the shortest, I think it has a way in our subconscious of evoking the coming forth into being. I mean, we know that plants begin their lives underground. We begin our lives in a kind of dark womb. There's all these different ways in which there are shells and other enclosures that are the beginning of things. So it's a time of year that does harken back to something originary, something original. So, and that episode that you're referring to was a rather short one because I wanted the poems that I read to have the maximum amount of resonance. Therefore, I kept my own sort of commentary on the time of year as well as the poems to a strict minimum.
You know, it's funny, amongst the things that, you know, you listed that gestate in the darkness, one of them that you didn't mention is something you were actually talking about in a recent show when you were talking about the great oxygenation of the planet, which, you know, came from bacteria. And I imagine, I mean, bacteria do much better in dark, warm spaces, right?
It's really extraordinary when you think about the history of the Earth and how in the beginning, before the emergence of the most primitive forms of life, which were bacteria, and in particular cyanobacteria, that the atmosphere of the Earth was very hostile to any development of life, the way most of the atmospheres of the planets of our solar system are. And when bacteria came into being and learned this process of photosynthesis, millennia, millions, and then billions of years of this relentless metabolism of bacteria, especially cyanobacteria, would release oxygen as a byproduct of photosynthesis. And gradually, it created an atmosphere that surrounds the Earth as a kind of thin membrane of spirit, which is now 21% oxygen. And it's been 21% for a long time. And there's this miraculous way in which the Earth calibrates the oxygen content in the atmosphere to always remain at around 21%, whatever happens in terms of the highs and lows, it always goes back to that baseline. And that is what enabled life to emerge from the oceans, colonize the land. It gave rise to the different genres of life, mammals, avian life, plant life. So all of us owe an immense debt to microorganisms and the way that they gestated this living biosphere that we belong to, as you said, in the ocean, in the dark, by, however, using the power of sunlight. No?
So in a sense, I had that just absolutely backwards, because that's the bacteria that really, you know, that thrives on light. But it's interesting, you know, it's a time of symbols that play with light and dark. And one of the things I loved about you're talking about this birth of the atmosphere is that you call it the thin blue line. That's one of the best rebrands of a terrible political term I've ever heard.
Well, it's not me who calls it the thin blue line. I wish I could take credit for it. It's a term the astronauts use when they look at Earth from outer space. And they see a beautiful planet, and then there's this very thin, luminescent blue line, which is The most is 60 miles deep, which is in the infinity of space, absolutely nothing. And everything in the universe takes place within this thinnest of blue lines, which is the surface of the Earth, maybe about 50 miles high, maybe just a few miles deep in the oceans. It's where the biosphere is located, and it's where things come to appearance. As far as we know, our planet is the only place where anything comes to appearance, and maybe the only place where the universe reveals a tiny sliver of itself in terms of starlight space. We look out there and we see a small portion of what's out there, and it might be the only place where appearance happens. So it's quite remarkable that without this thin atmosphere that gives us a membrane of protection against the noxious ultraviolet radiations from the sun, but also allows enough of that sunlight to come in and be photosynthesized so that life can happen. It's an incredible alchemy, very delicate and extremely fragile, ultimately.
Speaking of things that gestate in the dark, in your recent episode celebrating the 20th anniversary of Entitled Opinions, you describe the cave-like environment of the radio studio at KCSU. Would you talk to me a little bit about how this descent into a basement results in conversation gestating, ideas gestating between you and your guests?
Yeah, because KCSU is, you know, the college station for Stanford, and you do have to descend about 5 steps into what really, once you open that door and enter into it, it's very, you know, radio station-like. It's a bit of an underworld. It's what Michel Foucault would have called a heterotopia, a place that is other than the ordinary places we inhabit. And the Studio B, where most of our recordings would take place, is also a dark space where you have, you know, the console with its lights. And I would always keep the lights relatively dim and engage in conversation when I was doing shows that involved inviting a guest and having dialogue take place, or even when the monologues were being recorded, keep the space dark enough. Because it was, as you say, it's cavern-like, it's womb-like. It's also what I frequently call on the show, and I think, you know, my longtime listeners are probably getting sick of me referring to it as the catacombs of KZSU, where we, on Entitled Opinions, practice the persecuted religion of thinking, referring here to the catacombs of Rome, where the early Christians, who were still being persecuted, held their masses and so forth. So, yeah, this descent into an underworld to converse with the dead, which happens in so many epic poems. We have that katabasis, it's called in Greek, where the hero could be Odysseus, it could be Aeneas, Dante does it, descends into the realm of the dead in order to hold converse with those shades. And there's something about doing that in the radio medium, which is very appropriate because there's something spooky about a medium which doesn't have a visual component. It's audio. So you're hearing disembodied voices, but it's in the disembodiment of the voice that the voice has this extra dark, imageless space in which to resound. And that's why I love the medium of radio.
Listening to this episode, my son, who's 10 years old, was in the car with me, and he heard you and your guests say that ghosts can listen to radio frequencies, but not to podcasts. And my son was taken by it. He said, "You need to get on the radio, Mom. You need to get on the real radio right away." But it is an interesting thing to contemplate because, much like in this season, the membrane between the embodied voice and the disembodied voice, the living and the dead, dissolves a little bit.
I think radio is also, because of the history of the radio, that I say that when it first happened many people believe that it was a spiritualistic medium, that you could really, if not communicate with the dead through radio, that you could make yourself heard by it. Something has to do with tuning into frequencies. The idea that you could go by, you know, slight turns of the dial, you could go into deep kind of space, not cosmic space necessarily, but, you know, if you're especially on AM and on the broadband, you could sometimes tune into voices from Moscow or from Africa or things like that. And so it seemed to be a place where weird voices that could make themselves heard across barriers that exist in embodied time and space. Podcasts did not have that power to cross thresholds in the same way as radio when it's live and you tune the dial. And somehow I always get the sense that you never know who's out there listening when you're on the radio.
The element of randomness disappears with a podcast.
It's random. It's also, you know, with a podcast, you have to tune into it. You have to, you don't even tune into it. What you have to do is you have to access it through a particular means. And it doesn't have the promiscuity of moving the dial just a little bit and you're all of a sudden elsewhere. You know what I mean? I don't know, your son, I think he would intuitively grasp what I'm talking about, right? So having said that, 99.999% of my listeners are accessing Entitled Opinions through the podcast medium. So I continue to air on KZSU, first thing because I have a commitment to that station. I mean, a sentimental commitment and a sort of contractual commitment. And also because I believe in the magic of radio.
Just to move on to the Dunn poem that we're talking about today, I wanted to speak for a second about a passage that reminded me of another one of your recent episodes. There's a moment in the poem where Dunn is placing himself outside of the renewing circuit of the solstice and the seasons. And one of the things he claims, among a lot of other things, is that stones are able to love and to detest. Even he doesn't have feelings. He's completely dead to the world, but stones can emote in these ways. This made me think of a remarkable recent episode where you talked with the physicist Aaron Breidenbach, who thinks about crystals and their powers in quantum mechanics on a few different levels.
Well, you have to have a degree in physics and a PhD in order to say something like that and not have it considered just woo-woo talk. And this guest that I had just finished defended his dissertation in quantum physics. And he works with two different kinds of crystals in particular, and has shown, you know, at the scientific level that there's a way in which they have their own sort of intelligence. And that's why these two crystals are prime candidates for a kind of supercomputing, a quantum computing for the future that hasn't yet materialized, but a number of people are on their way to making it happen. So the more you look into the nature of crystals, and Aaron should be here really to explain that, but the more you learn about crystals, the more one realizes that they have certain patterns and fluidities that are very close to being things like communication, like synthesis, analysis, things that have a certain kind of intelligence, and that they also seem to have an awareness of their environment. So in that regard, the distinction between the animate and the inanimate seems to get very thin and blurred when you are looking at these crystals at the quantum level. You have to look at them, I think, at the quantum level in order to appreciate the degree to which it becomes difficult to maintain this rigid separation between what is alive and what is not alive. You know? And my guest on that show was firmly convinced that there is an animate quality to these crystals that he's working with.
I mean, it is incredible. The walls that are being broken down between the adamate and the inanimate in almost everywhere.
And eventually, I'm convinced and have always been convinced that eventually both philosophy and science will come around to finding reasons why the poets from antiquity to our own time, that they're sort of lending a voice to the inanimate is something that is not outlandish at all from the scientific point of view. You know, this idea of the pathetic fallacy, this is a term in literary history. Pathetic fallacy is where Shelley will speak to the west wind in his ode to the west wind and will personify it and consider it sentient and having intention and so forth. And this idea that it's a fallacy, well, there's something about the pathetic fallacy which is not fallacious when you look at the incredibly subtle transgressions that take place at the threshold between the animate and the inanimate from even a scientific point of view. So, yeah, eventually I think we're going to wake up to the fact that the whole world is alive on this planet. And it's alive thanks again to the thin blue line and that kind of special alchemy of the atmosphere that makes at least the surface of our planet a living organism. The whole thing is a living organism.
It's incredible. I wanted to talk a little bit about your relationship with the memorized verse.
I guess I belong to that generation where, you know, poetry was really, it was a premier language of literacy. And it was not uncommon in dorms when I was in college. People, you know, would spend a whole weekend on a bed, you know, reading Sylvia Plath or some other poet. And poetry was just automatically memorized by people, not as an exercise or anything, but when you read a poem and you really love it, it's just an instinctive urge that you have to commit it to memory. And by memorizing it, you're metabolizing it. And it takes on a life of its own within your own psyche. So being a rather avid reader of poetry, I ended up committing to memory a number of poems. And I still know them. And every now and then I'll memorize a new one. But they're invariably poems that struck me, that spoke to me in a particularly powerful way. And therefore, they now become a part of me. That's what memorization does. You incorporate.
What has struck you recently?
Well, recently, they're poems of Rainer Rilke. But even though that they're in translation, or they're, you know, an Italian poem, you know, because I'm an Italian, so I teach French and Italian literature, so there's poems in French and Italian. So Rimbaud, beautiful, it's a prose poem called Génie or Genius, and it's rather long. It's the last poem, one of the last poems in this collection of illuminations, and I just had to, you know, memorize it. And of course, you have to keep up with it. And the thing about memorization is that, you know, you have to keep practicing those poems. But there are two poems of Rimbaud's that recently awoke in me the urge to memorize. Every now and then, you know, I teach Dante a lot, the Divine Comedy, and I can recite long passages, my favorite passages there. And often, you know, in teaching it again, I come across other tercets or two or three tercets, and I feel like I have to commit that to memory. Yeah.
When we spoke yesterday, you mentioned to me that one poem you memorized some time ago and you've loved and kept with you is Ezra Pound's translation of The Seafarer,
right?
Old English. I hadn't read it, so I looked it up yesterday, and it was really moving, and just an avalanche of seafaring literature that I've loved kind of came back to mingle with my reactions to this poem. And what are some of the passages that return to you the most? Because it's a long poem.
Well, it's a long poem, and he is transcribing into his own modern English one of the oldest Anglo-Saxon poems, I think from the 10th, 11th century, something in Old English. And the kind of poetry of this early Anglo-Saxon prosody was based on alliteration rather than rhyme. So you would have these lines would typically have three either consonants, sometimes vowels, and then a fourth that would not be alliterative. So, you know, you have that coldly afflicted, my feet were by frost benumbed, chill its chains are, chaffing sighs hew my heart round, and hunger begot mere weary mood. And you know, lest man know not that he on dry land loveliest liveth. Listen, how I, on ice-cold sea, weather the winter, wretched outcast, deprived of my kinsmen. That's, you know, the first part of the opening of the poem.
In memorizing, you get used to the rhythms of iambic pentameter and the reliability of rhymes. So it's interesting to memorize.
Yes. The older I get, the more I remember the end of the poem, which is Ezra Pound gives it a rather bleak worldview. And this idea that days little durable and all the arrogance of earthen riches, there come now no kings nor Caesars nor gold-giving lords like those gone. Waneth the watch, but the world holdeth. No man at all going the earth's gate, but age fares against him. Gray-haired he groaneth, his face paleth. Anyway, you get the idea that it has this power to express in rather, you could call it harsh or guttural, but it's also just very raw, powerful blocks of emotion that come through there.
Right. One like tiny passage that stuck with me right away was when he was describing how much the sea pulls on him. You know, it's like the opening pages of Moby Dick too. Moaneth alway my mind's lust that I fare forth and afar hence seek out a foreign fastness. The foreign fastness stuck with me because it's this human condition to speed things up and.
Right, exactly. And
regret that lust.
Yes, and longing comes upon him to fare forth on the water. I think that's in that section of the poem as well, no?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you for introducing me to that poem. I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's not unlike the poem that we're going to turn to by John Donne in the sense that it's a winter poem. Obviously, the seafarer is someone who has been in exile, you know, from his tribe, and he seems to be alone on the harsh sea, as he calls it. And the imagery is snow, ice, and wind, and darkness. So it's.
And there are so many moments when he's thinking about the joys and comforts of other people.
Yes.
Like Donne does in this poem. I mean, he's imagining the burghers wine drunk and, you know,
right,
playing the harp and wearing rings. You know?
That's right. And that he's outside of that. He's outside of that warmth, the circle. Yeah. He hath not heart for harping, nor in ring having, nor winsomeness to wife, nor any wit else save the waves slash. And longing comes upon him to fare forth on the water. So despite, you know, the chill and exile of being on the sea, it seems like something binds him to that element.
Beautiful. So before you read through A Nocturnal Upon St. Lucy's Day, could you contextualize this poem a little bit for us?
Well, yeah. This poem, I really do believe it's one of the really depressive poems of the Western canon. And Lord knows there's a lot of depressed poems. That's why I worry that all the cures for depression are really a war against the poetic spirit, because so much of poetry comes from that feeling of being down somehow. But it is in particular, you know, so it takes place on the winter solstice, and it's called a nocturnal upon St. Lucy's Day. And the thing about St. Lucy, it's a saint who is associated with the winter solstice, especially in Northern Europe, because although the winter solstice is the longest night of the year, it's that volatile moment when the earth takes a turn away from darkness into the light, no? Because after the 21st, our days get longer by 1 minute a day, and it goes until the summer solstice, which is the longest day of the year. And then the summer solstice also then turns back. So it's a remarkable kind of point where the coincidence of light and darkness are at the most intense, if you like. And he chooses that day to write this poem, which was written, I believe, in a what we would might even call a clinical depression after the death of his wife, Anne. His wife, Anne, was much beloved by John Donne. She died in 1617, just days after she had given birth to their 12th child. And he was thrown for a big loss by the loss of his wife. And this poem, therefore, features a speaker who is identifying with the deadness of the time of year, the darkness of it. The everything in the outside world seems to have come to a halt and things have become inanimate. And while the future days are going to bring new life back into the world, he says he will not be participating in this regeneration of light and life as the earth turns its axis, you know, towards the spring. But he will remain dead because his grief is just that deep and hopeless, helpless, if you want to use that term. Yeah. But having said that, it's an absolutely beautiful poem. And to read it is not depressive at all. Somehow the music is where all the life is located.
Right. It's absolutely true. And he throws so much hope onto the rest of the world too. I guess in some lines it reads a little bit as bitterness, but overall I don't think so. I mean, he wishes for everybody to enjoy the new lust that the goat runs to fetch and
But sure, and this, what's affirmative about the poem is that it affirms his attachment and his love for his wife, and that is not going to die. And it's because his love will not die that he is going to be as if dead on the earth without her. And this represents, in my view, at least an affirmation of an attachment. And this is what happens in moments of deep grief, is that the danger of, you know, falling into this deep mourning is that the temptation is to die along with the dead rather than find a way to have the dead die in you so that you can overcome the grief. So I, in some sense, the latter alternative can be even more depressing. Namely, yes, you let the dead die and then you move on to something else. But the former, where you almost are choosing to, you know, to die with the dead, has such a declaration of allegiance that, you know, there's something beautiful about that.
Right. It's seeking a transformation rather than a return to the daily, to the quotidian after a death.
Shall we read it?
Thank you so much. Yes.
A Nocturnal Upon St. Lucy's Day. 'Tis the year's midnight, and it is the day's Lucy's, who scarce 7 hours herself unmasks. The sun is spent, and now his flasks send forth light squibs, no constant rays. The world's whole sap is sunk, the general balm the hydroptic earth hath drunk. Wither as to bed's feet,
life is shrunk, dead and interred. Yet all these seem to laugh compared with me, who am their epitaph. Study me then, you who shall lovers be at the next world, that is, at the next spring. For I am every dead thing in whom love wrought new alchemy. For his art did express a quintessence even from nothingness, from dull privations and lean emptiness. He ruined me, and I am rebegot of absence, darkness, death, things which are not. All others from all things draw all that's good, life, soul, form, spirit, whence they have being. I, by love's limbeck, am the grave of all that's nothing. Oft a flood have we two wept, and so drowned the whole world, us two. Oft did we grow to be two chaoses, when we did show care to aught else, and often absences withdrew our souls and made us carcasses. But I am, by her death, which word wrongs her, of the first nothing the elixir grown. Were I a man, that I were one, I needs must know, I should prefer, if I were any beast, some ends, some means, yea, plants, yea, stones detest, and love. All some properties invest. If I an ordinary nothing were, as shadow, a light, and body must be here. But I am none, nor will my sun renew. You lovers, for whose sake the lesser sun at this time to the goat is run, to fetch new lust and give it you. Enjoy your summer all. Since she enjoys her long night's festival, let me prepare toward her, and let me call this hour her vigil and her eve, since this, both the years and the days, deep midnight is.